Hello, and welcome to 15 Minute History. Each week, we teach you about historical people, events, and places in 15 minutes. If this is your first time here, then thanks for joining us. Stay connected with us wherever you listen to podcasts and at our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org, where you can find these recordings and transcripts for each episode. Now, let's start the show.
It is said that famous men are usually the product of unhappy childhoods. The stern compression of circumstances, the twinges of adversity, the spur of slights and taunts in early years are needed to evoke that ruthless fixity of purpose and tenacious mother wit without which great actions are seldom accomplished. Winston Churchill, Marlborough.
They walked through the park and, coming up on a stream, found the shallows and tried to cross. He went first, forging the way for her to show the best path. At the midpoint, his shoe slipped upon a rock and he fell in. She and their friend laughed. As he composed himself, he joined them and raised his wet face to the warm sun. They offered to help him out of the water, but he refused. The cold water of the stream falling over his submerged legs and waist, he continued his conversation with them, both occasionally splashing and popping bubbles as they formed from the foam. When Winston Churchill finally rose from the water, he took no assistance and issued no complaint. I accept the circumstances in which we fall. The strength of knowing that we are all wet is the reality of accepting our station. From there, we may walk on. The three emerged back on the path and walked on. Early life and influence. Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill was born to Lord Randolph and Lady Jenny Churchill on November 30, 1874, in his ancestral home of Blenheim Palace. Direct descendants of the Dukes of Marlborough, the Churchill family were part of the highest levels of British aristocracy. Despite this, and due to some unsavory actions by his father, Randolph Churchill, Winston and his family spent his early years in Dublin. His earliest memory was of a speech given by his grandfather at the unveiling of a statue in Phoenix Park where he, at the age of three, gained a reverence for the British monarchy that he would carry for the rest of his life. His other memory was of being thrown from a donkey after encountering the march by the Rifle Brigade, in which he sustained a concussion of the brain, later saying, "This was my first introduction to Irish politics." His mother was a socialite and his father an elected official to the House of Commons, which left little time for Winston or his brother Jack. The neglect of Winston is well recorded both in the Journal of Lord Randolph and in the Diary of Lady Jenny, the latter only including small notes of "saw the children" among the sea of entries detailing teas, social events, and evenings with suitors. One saving grace during this period in Winston's life was the influence of his loving nanny, Elizabeth Everest, whom he would write about later as, "She had been my dearest and most intimate friend during the whole of the 20 years I had lived." At the age of 7, he was sent to St. George's School in Ascot, Berkshire, where he performed poorly and regularly misbehaved. It was during this time that he began his lifelong habit of memorizing large amounts of text and prose. After a terrible experience at St. George's, he was sent to Brunswick School in Hove. There he became a voracious reader, consuming any and all books he could access, in addition to pursuing other activities that he would use later in his life, such as learning French, history, writing, swimming, and memorizing poetry. He barely passed entrance exams for the elite Harrow School, where he would stay until being accepted into the Royal Military Academy and Sandhurst. For 15 months, he was trained as a cavalryman before graduating in 1894. During this time, his father, Lord Randolph, began to degrade mentally due to an undisclosed illness. His mother, from whom Randolph was now entirely estranged, went to her husband's side and the two decided to do a round-the-world trip. Winston later recalled, "I never saw him again, except as a swiftly fading shadow." His father's death had a profound effect on the young Winston. Napoleon, one of his heroes, said, "If you want to know a man, look at the world when he was 20." For Winston, his early habits of romanticization spilled over into, or originated from, his need to know his father and make him proud. This need would be present for the rest of his life. The Rising Leader. In 1894, a 20-year-old Winston gave his first public speech. Not long after, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the 4th Queen's Own Hussars Regiment of the British Army and did his best to use his mother's influence to be sent into an active war zone. He and a friend went to Cuba to observe the War of Independence, where Winston encountered his first taste of combat. He took this experience with him when he traveled to India, which was under British control. There, he sought to remedy his self-diagnosed illness of being poorly educated by reading widely, beginning with Gibbon's 4,000-page The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which he reread two additional times in his life. He also spent time learning about politics, asking family and friends back home to send him copies of the Annual Register so he could stay attuned to British parliamentary affairs. He would also request speeches from the House of Commons and other writings linked to that branch of government. These verbal engagements captivated a young Churchill, influenced his rising interest in politics, and inspired his hard-fought ability to speak publicly that he would master later in life. While in India, Winston fought in a large battle in the Swat Valley, which later in life he fatalistically and sarcastically described as, "They wanted to shoot us, and we wanted to shoot at them." So a lot of people were killed, and on our side, their widows have had to be pensioned by the imperial government, and the others badly wounded and hopped around for the rest of their lives, and it was all very exciting. And for those who did not get killed or hurt, they were very jolly. After his time in India, he petitioned to serve in the Sudan under Herbert Kitchener, at which he succeeded. The war was bloody and revealing for Churchill, as he became increasingly critical of Kitchener's methods and treatment of enemy wounded, especially after the Battle of Omdurman, where the British fought a major Sudanese leader and his forces. As a result, Churchill did not elect to stay once his service was up. Back in England, he wrote his second book, The River War, documenting the campaign and his experiences in South Africa. During this time, he conducted his first political campaign as a conservative and Tory Democrat, but lost narrowly to his liberal opponent. As news of a second Boer War began to spread in 1899, Winston sailed as a journalist, writing both for the Daily Mail and the Morning Post, to Cape Town with plans to proceed to Ladysmith, which was under siege by Boer troops. During the journey, his train was derailed by shelling from the Boers, and he was taken as a prisoner of war. After a short period, the 25-year-old Winston learned the guard rotation and, during an opportune moment, scaled the fence surrounding the camp and escaped. Having gained his freedom, he now needed to cross over 300 miles of enemy territory with no map, compass, food, or money. He looked to the stars to guide him, saying, "Orion shone brightly. He should lead me to freedom." Upon his return, he was lauded with praise for his escape from the camp. He used this newfound notoriety to once again attempt to gain public office as a member of Parliament. This time he was successful, elected as one of the Conservative candidates for Oldham in October 1900. As stated by Andrew Roberts in his book, Churchill, Walking with Destiny, before the new MP had even taken his seat, he had fought in four wars, published five books, written 215 newspaper and magazine articles, participated in the greatest cavalry charge in half a century, and made a spectacular escape from prison. At 25, he had fought on more continents than any soldier in his tour, save for Napoleon, and seen as many campaigns as any living general. This glorious, delicious war. His conservative loyalty didn't last long. Dissatisfaction with conservative policies, infighting within the party, and his outspoken support of liberal candidates led him to cross the floor in 1904, defecting from the conservatives to sit as a member of the Liberal Party, which gained the majority in the election that same year. Winston served in several positions in the new government, such as President of the Board of Trade, Home Secretary, and finally, First Lord of the Admiralty. As First Lord, Churchill spent years building up naval bases, fleets, and stations, all while researching new technology that could give the British an edge in combat. This increased in 1912 as a result of Germany passing its Navy Law and strengthening its maritime forces. As the Germans continued their military buildup, Churchill was more and more convinced that war was on the horizon. Preparing the British fleet for the impending conflict was his singular focus. As described by a commandant, everything was subordinated in his mind to a single purpose, getting the fleet ready for a war in which Germany would be the enemy. The First World War began in 1914, and the prepared Churchill embarked on the Great War like a dynamo, organizing meetings, attending the War Cabinet, and streamlining communications and decision-making at the Admiralty. It wasn't long before the Navy transported over 120,000 troops to France, began the blockade of German seaports, landed Marines in strategic locations, and sent submarines to cut German naval supply lines. As the war drew on and the casualties mounted, Churchill looked to the Royal Navy to break the stalemate through an offensive. His attention went to aiding the Russians in the east by launching an offensive against Turkey in the Dardanelles. The Gallipoli campaign saw almost 350,000 British and Allied forces combat 315,000 Turkish forces. The 10-month campaign ended in absolute disaster, resulting in her full withdrawal. The blame was laid on Churchill, who stepped down from the Admiralty, though he still remained an MP. Instead of retreating into private life, he went to the trenches of Europe to fight the Germans. This move was the first step in the restoration of his name in both the public and private realm. Upon his return to England, he went on to serve as the Minister of Munitions, then Secretary of State for War and Air, and then Secretary of State for the Colonies. The Wilderness Years. In 1922, he lost his seat during a change in government until he became the Chancellor of the Exchequer 2 years later and officially rejoined the Conservative Party. Everyone said that I was the worst Chancellor of the Exchequer that ever was, and now I'm inclined to agree with them. So now the world is unanimous, said Churchill of himself in 1930. The Conservative Party was defeated in 1929, and though Winston retained his parliamentary seat, a new Labour government was forming, and he soon found himself out of power. Called the Wilderness Years, 1929 to 1939 saw an out-of-office Churchill remaining active in politics while pursuing his personal interests and generating income to compensate for his losses during the stock market crash of 1930. He began his work on Marlborough, His Life and Times, a 2,000-plus page biography of his ancestor, John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough. Despite not holding office, he continued to draw crowds with his parliamentary speeches and embraced speaking opportunities all over Great Britain and the United States. He delivered an average of 51 speeches per year, totaling over 500 by the end of 1939. In addition, he wrote hundreds of newspaper and magazine articles and befriended American businessmen and celebrities, such as William Randolph Hearst and Charlie Chaplin. As his oratory and writing skill kept him in the public eye, he worked behind the scenes to stay aligned and befriend new political contacts. Throughout all his activities, both in public speaking and writing, a warning emerged that wove itself into the threads of his vast work during those years. It was a warning that would be almost unique to Churchill, and which spoke of the rising evil that was Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany. Seizing the premiership. Let us free the world from the approach of a catastrophe, carrying with it calamity and tribulation beyond the tongue of man to tell. Such speeches like this one from 1936 were common from Churchill, who argued in favor of rearmament of British forces, investment in air power, raising questions about Germany's military buildup and the need for the British government to distrust Hitler's promises. Political opponents dismissed his oratory flourishes with attacks on his judgment, citing failings in the past such as the Gallipoli campaign. In 1937, Neville Chamberlain became Prime Minister, a move that was first celebrated by Churchill. However, it soon became apparent that Chamberlain's goal was appeasement rather than action, since the Prime Minister believed that the world had seen enough war and thought trade agreements and defensive alliances would stop the German and Italian juggernauts. This culminated in 1938 with the Munich Agreement, which saw Great Britain allow Nazi Germany to annex what was then Czechoslovakia. The pact was celebrated across Europe as a deterrent to war, and Chamberlain returned to Great Britain as a hero. Back in the House of Commons, Churchill eviscerated the agreement as a total and unmitigated disaster. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup which will be proffered to us year by year, unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor we rise again and take our stand for freedom as in the olden time. As history has shown, Churchill was right. Nazi forces continue to move across Europe, asking for peace after each advance and pressuring the world to answer with either a declaration of war or a signature proving that they would do nothing to stop it. 1 year later, Great Britain declared war on Germany after its invasion of Poland, and Churchill was reappointed First Lord of the Admiralty. Over the next 9 months, Churchill would work to slow the Nazis down by launching an offensive in Norway. In May 1940, the Nazis invaded France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. In that same week, the Labour Party opposition had pushed for a vote of no confidence in the Chamberlain government. The Prime Minister responded by trying to form a coalition, but it was clear that the majority would not serve under his leadership. In contrast, there was considerable support for both Winston and Lord Edward Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, who turned down the premiership. At this, Chamberlain, knowing he was finished, advised the King to send for Churchill, who accepted the role of Prime Minister on May 10, 1940. The years that followed would be the test that Winston had prepared for his entire life. At last, I had the authority to give direction over the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure that I should not fail. I could discipline the bloody business at last. I had no feeling of personal inadequacy or anything of that sort. Therefore, although impatient for the morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams. I went to bed at 3 o'clock, and in the morning, I said to Clemmy, my wife, there is only one man who can turn me out, and that is Hitler. Thank you for joining us on 15 Minute History. Please take a moment and leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. We hope that you will join us for a discussion segment and come back next week as we walk in history's footsteps, 15 minutes at a time.